name is Cheryl Weir, and I'm the project manager for the Healthy Environments Partnership, and I am presenting with Chris Kuhn, who is actually the person responsible for this study. So Chris will explain the study. I'll give you an introduction to the Healthy Environments Partnership and who we are and how we work. The title of this presentation is Mental Well-Being in Neighborhood Socioeconomic Context, Comparing Measures of Mental Health in a Multi-Ethnic Urban Environment, and that environment is Detroit, Michigan. I'd like to acknowledge, obviously, Chris and Amy Schultz, who's the PI, and Barbara Israel, the co-PI, along with the other people that you see on there. And on behalf of the Healthy Environments Partnership, which is the group that we work with. The object of this presentation or this study is to compare the effects of different aspects of the neighborhood socioeconomic context on several dimensions of mental health. This slide acknowledges the partnership, and you can see there are a number of organizations that are a part of our partnership. They represent all three areas of the city of Detroit. We work in the southwest, we work on the east side, and we work northwest side in an area called Brightmoor. Those are our three study areas, and so the representative organizations are across those three areas. In addition, our partnership is a collaborative between not just community organizations, obviously, but also academia and health service providers. Healthy Environments Partnership uses a community-based participatory research approach to examine and address aspects of the social and physical environment that contribute to racial and ethnic socioeconomic disparities in health. We use the CBPR approach to develop the research questions and also to develop interventions to address some of the conditions that we find as we do our work. Community-based participatory research does involve, it is an approach that involves the partnership and in all phases, not just in terms of after we've decided what the research question is and after we've decided to do the research. It brings people together prior to the establishment of decisions about the research question to do what should it be, how should we think about the research, what are some of the methods we'll use, and also how do we disseminate the findings once we have findings, and lastly, to think through how do we apply those findings to develop interventions that benefit the community. A little background on Detroit. The setting for this particular study, as I said, is Detroit, Michigan, and it is an older industrial city, which at one time was a very prosperous city. Highly industrial auto industry, most of you know about that, but also Detroit had one of the highest rates of home ownership of anywhere in the country in over 100 different historic neighborhoods. But over the past 50 years, a lot of transition has occurred, and that transition is a result of deindustrialization, as I'm sure most people have heard about what's going on with the auto industry, but also extreme racial segregation. And so what you've have now is a lot of concentrated poverty in the city, and then you have the middle class and the more wealthy on the outskirts in the suburbs. And you can kind of look and see how the population numbers have changed over the last 50 years, as well as the ethnic makeup of the city. This particular map gives an illustration of concentrations of poverty in the tri-county areas, and including Detroit is the bottom under the dark line, and you can see the concentration of poverty in Detroit is pretty intense compared to some of the outlying counties. And in each of the counties, there are most of the places where you see the darker concentrations, there are higher levels of African-American population in those as well, which gives some credence to the research that says that, you know, in part, race and income and ethnicity and income kind of go hand in hand. And this particular map then shows the percent African American, and if you sort of overlay the two maps, you'll see that the poverty and the percent African American are really strongly associated. Racial segregation and the concentration of poverty and wealth determined what resources are available in neighborhoods. That's pretty obvious, I think. And those resources often are those resources that are either protective against disease or those that put people at higher risk for disease. And so now Chris is going to talk more about what the actual study entails.
Okay, so it's within this context that we're doing this study. And the question was, how do different aspects of the socioeconomic environment of neighborhoods, residential neighborhoods, where people live, where people raise their children, where people operate every day, how do aspects of that economic structure affect and influence different aspects of mental health? And in particular, we were looking at structural characteristics of neighborhoods as influencing mental health because they're an important source of not only chronic stress, but acute stressors such as loss of jobs or loss of housing through foreclosures, what have you. And also because neighborhood environments are relatively persistent and uncontrollable. So to do this study, we used multi-level modeling. That is, we looked at individuals as nested within neighborhoods. And we had a community study done by the Healthy Environments Partnership that was a stratified multi-stage probability sample. And that is, we wanted to get approximately equal representation across different racial groups and across different economic groupings, so that we would be allowed to do comparisons across groups. So that was the individual level data from a face-to-face interview, and then the neighborhood level data is from the U.S. Census, and we used block group as a proxy for neighborhoods. So here's a few characteristics of the sample itself of the individuals. As you can see the rough mix racially and ethnically. Household income, I wanted to point out that, again, in Detroit, this is in Detroit, we've got a fairly compressed income structure there. So even though there's a distribution across these levels of income, you notice that when we say 40,000 and over 16%, we're talking about that over is quite small. So we're talking about a community or a sample here that is very impoverished, poverty, and then low income to moderate income, and then middle income primarily. To point out the high rate of homeownership, about half homeowners, and long-term residence in the neighborhoods. Okay, characteristics of the neighborhoods in the sample. Again, you can see the racial mix and a wide range. As Cheryl pointed out, there is a skew of economic segregation and racial segregation in this community. These neighborhoods, the residential stability, that is, the proportion of people within the neighborhood who have lived there for 5 years or longer, this is fairly high, but it has quite a range. Median household income, $27,000. That's compared to about $42,000 in the year 2000 nationally. Okay, in this study, mental health outcomes that we used were life satisfaction, symptoms of depression, and major depressive disorder. That's 12 months. Life satisfaction, just one question for life satisfaction, and you can see the range of responses among individuals are not a very even distribution, so I did some fiddling around with this variable to see what was meaningful in this study. Symptoms of depression, measured by the CESD. And then major depressive disorder, we used the CD, and in particular the UMCD. And I wanted to point out the prevalence of major depression in this sample was 18% among African Americans and 21.8%. And that's pretty darn high. And I wanted to point out that a national prevalence study by David Williams and colleagues recently showed a 5.9% across African Americans, a national sample, and 6.9% among whites. Individual covariates that were included in the model, these are characteristics that have been associated either with mental health outcomes and with neighborhood effects. The neighborhood measures for this study, I have two measures of neighborhood income, and those are middle income and above, and percent poverty. And we wanted to look at middle income and above because the studies that have looked at the different levels of neighborhood income and how they affect health typically look at affluence on one hand and poverty on the other. And I wanted to look at that middle income, the importance of middle income residents of neighborhoods. And finally, this residential stability. This model is included because, consistent with the literature, neighborhood income or economic characteristics of neighborhoods in and of themselves largely do not have a significant main effect. And so there tends to be moderated or mediated by other characteristics of neighborhoods. So I'm looking at the joint effect of neighborhood income and residential stability on mental health outcomes. So the results are there were no significant neighborhood effects for either life satisfaction or depressive symptoms. However, for major depression, there was a significant effect. And that effect was similar both for middle income as an income variable and also for poverty as an income variable, but in the reverse direction. Middle income, the proportion of middle income residents in the neighborhood had a stronger effect than poverty. So I'm going to focus on that for the remainder of our results here. So it's important now to understand just what this means. This slide shows that the proportion of the variance in this models that were due to neighborhood effects, as opposed to the individual characteristics of those who live in the neighborhood, was 18% for depression. Okay, so here's what this interaction looks like if you break it apart. What we have is the predicted probability of depression for those at the group that is at most risk of depression, major depression. So on the x-axis is residential stability, from low to high residential stability. And what these lines are is that this line with this trajectory is are those neighborhoods that have a low proportion of middle-income neighbor residents. This is about 35%, or about a third of the residents are middle-income. And then this trajectory here is for those neighborhoods where half of the residents are middle-income. And so what you see is that stability, neighborhood stability, is associated with higher depression, increase in depression in those neighborhoods that have few middle-income residents, and stability as the neighborhood becomes more stable in those higher-income neighborhoods, then depression declines. So I wanted to point out a couple things. One is I want to look you to see the high predicted probability of depression, ranging from about 17% to 0.45, which is a 2.5 to 3 times gap there, and it's quite high. The other thing is that the findings for the very stable neighborhoods are sort of what we would expect, that if you have a stable neighborhood, that it may be beneficial for mental health if there's a fair amount of resources, economic resources within that community. But if your community is very low resourced and very stable, that it be detrimental to mental health. What is particularly interesting and has not been found in other studies is what we see on the left-hand side, whereas high proportion of middle-income neighborhoods that are in a lot of flux and turnover have a very high rate of depression, whereas there's a low rate of depression in those very low middle-income neighborhoods that are in flux. So I want to look briefly at why that might be, and we think it's important to look at what are the characteristics of those neighborhoods, what has been happening. If you look back to those slides and think of what's happened over the last 50 years, that means a lot of change is going on in neighborhoods. And that creates substantial stress for the people who live there. Not only chronic ongoing stress, but acute stressors like loss of income or fear of losing your job because your neighbor has, you've seen that, or fear of losing your home. So there's been a subsequent real disinvestment in those middle-income communities with high turnover. And likewise with the high turnover, low-income neighborhoods, it may be that those are actually neighborhoods for transition for people. So it may be neighborhoods in which low-income people are able to have some access within the constraints of being a very low-income community. I'm not meaning to underestimate the importance of those neighborhood factors. But there may be some sense of hopefulness because there may be higher availability of very low-level jobs to move into and out of, as opposed to loss of employment in those middle-income jobs, for example, with the auto industry, where you know they're not coming back. And there may be other economic buffers, like a high rental supply of rental housing. But we're not sure. And I think what this points out to is that in order for us to understand what's going on with mental health in communities like Detroit, in cities, we need to understand what are the characteristics of the neighborhood that people live in. How do those characteristics influence each other or jointly interact? And then create policies that will take that into account. Some strengths and weaknesses, as this was a cross-sectional study and there were some measures problem. But I think it's interesting because one is that it disclosed the really high prevalence of depression and the relationship with neighborhood characteristics. And it shows the need for us to regenerate neighborhoods in ways that provide supports for the existing residents, allow opportunities for some economic mobility, but also that we're able to target mental health services. We saw that really high probability of depression. Target to neighborhoods that we think are at particular risk.